Some Protestant denominations across the country are coming to accept same-sex marriage. This hour, one Iowa pastor on the questions they're facing. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also today, among our quick conversations to end the week, Iowa's three public universities propose tuition increases. ISU expands the surveillance of mosquito species with the potential to carry Zika virus. Two young eagles in Riverdale join a study to protect raptors from man-made hazards. The FDA moves to cut salt consumption by a third. And how the virtual city of Springfield studies the future of driving. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg about higher tuition on the way for Iowa's three public universities. But first, the Reformed Church in America is a Protestant denomination with a significant presence in Iowa. And this summer, in just a few days, at their General Synod, they'll consider whether their church sees marriage as between a man and a woman, or simply between two persons. We're joined now by someone who's written an opinion piece in the Des Moines Register recently about this, Pastor Cameron Barr, pastor of the Grinnell United Church of Christ, the United Church of Christ, an ecumenical partner of the Reformed Church in America. And welcome to our program, Pastor Barr.
Well, thank you, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
So you wrote this piece, even though you're not part of the Reformed Church in America, you won't be at this synod, as someone who wanted to weigh in on what's going to be taking place?
Well, that's right. You know, many religious traditions and denominations in our country have wrestled with the place of LGBT people in their communities. My own church has experienced some of those challenges, and the RCA is taking them up this summer. And so partly I just want to say that this isn't unusual. The RCA is having a conversation that many churches have had, and in fact, the United Methodists were having similar conversations at their general conference in Portland, Oregon, earlier this summer.
So tell us a little bit more about what will be happening at the Reformed Church in America Synod coming up in a few days. They'll be considering what questions?
Well, they have before them two contradictory constitutional amendments, one that would change their marriage liturgy to make marriage between two persons, and another that would change their marriage liturgy to affirm that marriage is between a man and a woman. And so they are in the midst of really a long dialogue in which they're trying to determine what their church's kind of general consensus on this would be. They've been through a lot of processes and conversations over the past couple of years. This is something they've been wrestling with for a long time. And they're going to see which of these two amendments, if either of them, can reach a two-thirds majority of delegates on the floor of their General Synod next week. And so it is the case that this could be an important step in their journey as a denomination as it relates to their relationship with LGBT people in their church.
Mm-hmm. Is it clear to you, looking in from the outside as a pastor of a an ecumenical partner church to the Reformed Church in America, how much support these amendments have?
Well, that's not clear to me at all. I don't have any idea what may be the outcome of their General Synod in another week or so. It is clear to me that they don't seem to have consensus on the matter, and they're going to see what happens, see if their delegates can resolve the issue for them. And that's been the case with so many other denominations, including my own church, the United Church of Christ. Consensus eluded us on the LGBT issues for many years. And any denomination that has tried to take a decision as a corporate body on LGBT issues has found that to be an uncomfortable decision to make and found it to come at some cost. And so we're all really interested to see what the RCA will do, but I'm not about to forecast what their decision may be. Mostly, we are praying for them. We want to to see their deliberations be honest and true. And I'm hopeful that they will reach a point where they are affirming LGBT people in the life of their church.
Mm-hmm. As your church, the United Church of Christ, debated this and came to the stance that you have right now, a welcoming stance to LGBT members of your congregation, what were the key questions that were debated? Where were the points of contention?
Well, this gets not just to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people that we may know in our own lives, but it also gets to questions of Scripture, how we interpret Scripture, and what authority we give to Scripture. It gets to questions of tradition, how we live into the traditions of our church, and what authority we give to those traditions. And so this really operates emotionally on many levels for everyone who's participating in the conversation. You know, coming out as a gay person or coming to know someone in your own family as a gay person, that's not an event. It really is a process. It takes time. And so what we're observing is that the RCA and so many other Christian denominations, they operate as rather extended families, families that are going through an emotional process in trying to understand their relationship to people that LGBT issues really affect, also their relationships with Scripture and tradition and many other things that are really dear to the heart and dear to the faith.
So back to the point of Scripture, what does Scripture have to say about gays and lesbians? Is it clear-cut or purely a matter of interpretation, do you think?
Well, I mean, there certainly are some passages of Scripture that are not friendly toward LGBT people. In my own tradition, we want to put those passages in context and understand them in terms of the genre and the history with which they were written. I also really believe that as a church, we are called to follow the greatest commandment of Jesus, which is to love the Lord with your whole heart, soul, strength, and mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And so we always want to interpret Scripture with themes of love and grace abiding through it.
Mm-hmm. At your church, the Grinnell United Church of Christ, Pastor Barr, are there same-sex marriage ceremonies?
Well, there certainly are. I, as a pastor, preside at same-sex marriage ceremonies. I am a gay person myself, and so we are a church that is incredibly varied, very diverse, economically, in terms of sexuality and levels of education. There are a lot of people who come to worship with us, and they are all really quite different, and we are held together by a covenant under God through which we try to love and care and support one another.
Okay, thank you very much, Pastor Cameron Barr, pastor of the Grinnell United Church of Christ. Thank you very much, Pastor Barr.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some news this week that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows. News this week, especially of interest to college students here in Iowa, or perhaps the parents of college students helping out with the costs of higher education. Iowa's public universities have proposed tuition increases for all students at all three campuses, in Cedar Falls at the University of Northern Iowa, in Ames at Iowa State University, and in Iowa City at the University of Iowa. For details on this, I'm joined by Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg. Hello again, Dean.
Hello, Ben. Talking about money, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And it's so relevant to so many people with the costs of higher education and what it means to a career.
Well, it is. You know, it's important to students who are working at, you know, minimum wage jobs or just a little bit above, trying to eke through a tuition. It's important to those parents who are trying to assist. But, you know, in the large scheme of things, do you think that the man on the street in Iowa really cares? I don't know.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about this latest proposal, because it comes in advance of next week's Iowa Board of Regents meeting. The Board of Regents oversees Iowa's public universities. The tuition levels approved in December called for freezing resident, yes, undergraduate tuition, yes, at all three public universities.
After 2 years, they had frozen it for 2 years, and they said, we will do it again, Iowa legislature, if you will give us the appropriation.
At two of the three at the UI, it was to go up by $100 per semester. So what happened to change, and what are the changes being proposed?
Well, the regents had asked the Iowa legislature for $20 million, roughly, a little bit over $20 million. The legislature appropriated about $7 million, so roughly about one-third of what the appropriation request was. Well, the regents had already said they would consider another year of tuition freeze if they got the appropriation that they were requesting. It came out to be about one-third of what they were requesting, so this is the result.
Okay, so what I know there are a lot of factors here, a lot of difference between undergraduate, graduate, in-state, out-of-state, but generally speaking, what can people expect in tuition increase here?
Well, let's talk about undergraduate Iowa residents, and they would see the tuition for undergraduate residents at the University of Iowa go to $7,178. At Iowa State and UNI, it would be $7,148, and, you know, roughly about the same, about $30 difference there. But that is the tuition that we're talking about. However, then consider what the overall costs are, because the regents had only recently also increased the fees for housing and meals. And so the document that they have sent out from the regents' office in advance of this consideration by the regents next Thursday at their meeting in Ames puts the cost of a year at the three state universities at $20,838. That's $600 more than it is at the current time.
Well, has there been any pushback on this? Are people accepting this, or are people saying, wait a minute, we're making the cost of public education out of reach for many people by doing this?
Well, we will see at the Regents' meeting. The regents have a tradition. In fact, they have it as part of their protocol that they don't raise tuition until they hear from student leaders. Now, generally, the student leaders come in and are very candid. I've often seen them oppose the tuition increase. Curiously, in recent times, they have supported a tuition increase. Even when it was being frozen, there was a feeling that, please don't set us up for big tuition increases here in the future by freezing tuition now. I remember one of the student leaders, and I don't remember which one, Iowa State or UNI, made the point of, we don't want to take advantage of tuition freezes right now, although we enjoy them at the current time, and I may graduate before you really hike tuition,
right?
So I'll get out. But we would rather see measured increases.
Tell us a little bit about the context here. How does this proposal to be discussed next week fit in with the region's overall strategy for the three public universities?
Well, the strategy is to restore what the funding has been, we'll say, 15 years ago. Back in about the year 2000, it was dramatically higher than it is right now. I'm not going to cite millions of dollars for you, but tuition during the years 2000 up to the present time has steadily declined from the state legislature to the regents' institutions, and it's dramatically lower than it was, say, 15 years ago. So the regents would like to see, at least to stop that erosion of the appropriation, and that has been in the last couple of years when they got the tuition freeze and they got sufficient appropriations from the legislature to freeze tuition, that has been somewhat stopped. But this year, as I just said, it went back to about one-third of what the regents said they needed.
Very quickly, before we have to go, Dean Borg, also this week, another lawsuit filed, I believe on Wednesday, over the hiring process of University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld last year. What's this latest suit about? What is the claim?
The suit is by a former University of Iowa. She's a retiree. Her name is Gerhild Kraft. She is a UI graduate, holds several degrees from the University of Iowa, including a law degree. She is seeking to invalidate the regents' action in appointing Bruce Harreld as president of the University of Iowa and asking some other things, too, to penalize the regents if they violate again, which he is alleging, they violated the open meetings law in Iowa. In meeting with Bruce Harreld, some of them did, before he applied for the University of Iowa. It was the day before the applications were due. But the regents contend we did not, the entire board wasn't meeting with him. We met in small groups, which were not of sufficient number to violate the open meetings law.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts to conclude on the potential impact of this or other lawsuits on this same hiring process question?
Well, it's more sand in the gears, I would say. I would put it that way. It's a hindrance to the regents putting this episode behind in advancing the institution. And it's a continued frustration, I think, for Bruce Harreld in establishing himself as the University of Iowa's leader.
Okay, thank you very much. Higher education update, so to speak, a couple of items. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you've no doubt noticed, along with this wonderful warm weather we've had, mosquitoes have returned, and with them the danger of the diseases they may carry, West Nile virus, and of course, we've heard in the news more recently the Zika virus. Iowa State University is continuing with its longstanding efforts to monitor West Nile virus and now expand surveillance of mosquito species with the potential to carry the Zika virus. Joining us to tell us about that, Ryan Smith, Assistant Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So keep us up to date. You have a significant history at ISU of keeping track of mosquito populations. Tell us about that first.
Yeah, sure. I'm actually relatively new to the business here, but several faculty have maintained a surveillance program here in the state for, I believe it's about 46 years now. And so we have a pretty good track record of what mosquito populations have looked like for almost 50 years now.
Mm-hmm. And there, some people may not be aware of it, thinking a mosquito is a mosquito, but there are many species of mosquitoes.
Oh, and that's exactly right. And there are several different species, several different types of mosquito, and each of them actually harbor different types of diseases of public health relevance.
Okay, so West Nile virus, give us an update on that.
So West Nile virus is still very pertinent here in Iowa. Every year, it seems like we have double digits in the number of confirmed cases, and actually in some years we actually have people die here in Iowa as a result of West Nile virus infection.
Mm-hmm. How many? What are the chances of contracting West Nile virus here in Iowa? It's only a certain one of these species or a few of them?
Sure, it's a Culex mosquito, usually Culex pipiens or Culex tarsalis, which are both found pretty prevalent here in the state. The chances, are usually pretty rare, and most of the time if you do interact with a mosquito that has contracted the virus, more than likely you don't have any symptoms. You just kind of brush it off as being a standard flu or cold. But in rare cases, actually, it does manifest into something that is much more severe.
Okay, Zika virus, of course, in the news in South America, not in North America so much. So why are you expanding efforts to track Zika? And this is connected with also one particular type of mosquito, right?
That's correct. At least with the West Nile, this involves Culex species, and it's really kind of where we've focused our program for about the last 15 years since West Nile has come into the country. With that being said, Zika is carried by Aedes mosquitoes, particularly Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. At least in the past, when we've done our surveillance, we've only detected very few, if any, Aedes albopictus, and it doesn't really appear as though they've actually established themselves here in Iowa. And we've actually yet to identify any of these Aedes aegypti species. So one of our major goals of these efforts is to actually see really if these mosquito species have established themselves here in the state to really assess any potential of Zika virus transmission here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Do we know that our climate, would our climate perhaps, our cold winters, prevent the Aedes aegypti from moving here?
Well, more than likely, I think our cold weather climate is probably keeping some of these mosquito populations at bay. Our climate is much different from a place like Florida, for instance, where these mosquitoes are widely prevalent.
Mm-hmm. Is there Zika in Iowa, possibly? Can we rule that out?
Well, I believe there's been 6 confirmed cases where people have brought it in from abroad, travel in different countries. But really, I think without having the mosquitoes that can possibly transmit the virus, any chances of really having the virus take hold here is very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. But of course, we have to consider climate change here. Iowa's climate could change in the coming decades. It looks like it is already changing.
Well, that is, as things get warmer, possibly the winters become a little bit warmer, and it actually could possibly allow some of these mosquito species to actually start to take hold here in the state, which is one of the reasons why we are really looking to see if they have taken hold in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about tracking populations of mosquitoes? It seems like, in contrast to birds or other animals, it would be very difficult.
Well, we actually set up a kind of a variety of different traps that are more focused on the certain type of mosquito species that we're looking for and possible certain stages. For instance, if we're trying to do virus surveillance for West Nile. But we go ahead and set up these traps, and they serve, they have attractants, whether they be light or CO2, to kind of mimic our own respiration. So more or less a mosquito is attracted to these sources and gets sucked in to the trap itself, and we process the samples and identify what mosquitoes they are.
Mm-hmm. What else are you monitoring regarding mosquitoes?
Well, as of right now, we're just trying to kind of continue our efforts in trying to assess the types of mosquito species there are and their abundance kind of throughout the year. As far as real surveillance, the only thing that we're really monitoring right now are West Nile.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the most immediate risk here for the state.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could end this conversation by reminding us of precautions we can take when we're going outdoors.
Sure. I mean, any time of spending significant time outdoors, there's always a risk of mosquitoes. And just wear protective clothing, insect repellents, and I think an important thing is just to remove any kind of standing water that might be in and around the house that serve as possible breeding sites for mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to kind of remove those nuisance bites that often happen during the summer.
I wonder, Ryan, is there anything to learn from your observation of West Nile virus over the past years about how the Zika virus might spread should it come to Iowa?
Well, it's, I think, a complete unknown, to be honest. We're dealing with different mosquitoes, and West Nile has kind of taken hold here in the state, which is maintained in bird populations, and at least Zika at this point doesn't appear to have a reservoir in which it is maintained. It appears to only cycle through mosquitoes in the human host. So there's a lot to be learned about how Zika is actually transmitted, and I think we're kind of definitely going down that path.
Okay, Ryan Smith, Assistant Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. Thanks for the update, Ryan.
All right, great. Thanks, Ben.
Still to come this hour, 2 young eagles in Riverdale, that's along the Mississippi, join a study to protect raptors from man-made hazards. The FDA moves to cut salt consumption by a third. And how the virtual city of Springfield studies the future of driving. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short pit stop. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to wrap up with quick conversations about some news we didn't get to otherwise in our talk shows this week. Well, 2 baby eaglets in the Iowa town of Riverdale, that's along the Mississippi near the Quad Cities, have been removed from their nest to become part of a migration study. Joining me now to tell us about it, Drew Becker, fish and wildlife biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He joins us from the Quad Cities. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Ben. Good to be here. Big fan of the show.
Oh, thank you very much. So Alcoa is a big employer in Riverdale, and these eagles, are they on the Alcoa grounds there?
They are. So, you know, Alcoa is a big, aluminum manufacturing kind of facility and have, you know, quite a bit of riverfront, and it just so happens that this nesting pair of eagles decided to make their home on Alcoa property. And John Rich is there in Alcoa several years ago, put up a camera kind of as an outreach strategy. And as I think a lot of folks are aware, it's become, you know, nationally a pretty popular camera for folks to view.
Oh, yeah. People love to see the eagles and their nest. So when these eagles, have these big these eaglets been taken out of their nest already, the baby eagles?
They have. So we on Monday, Memorial Day, we actually took them down. We had a jig lift, they call it, to get us up to the nest and brought them down safe and sound. And, you know, took several measurements and samples just because we don't often get those birds in hand and attach the telemetry units to their back and put them back. And you can look at the camera right now and see those units. And so far, they seem to be doing great.
Mm-hmm. How big are these eagles, these babies?
Sure. So the babies are full grown at this stage. You know, we estimate them to be about 8 weeks of age. And so their body size is the size they're going to be. So clearly when they start flying, their muscles will develop in a different way. But that's part of the reason why we can install these units at this stage in the game, because mm-hmm. they're not going to get any bigger in terms of bone structure.
Mm-hmm. I understand that the two birds are named Star and Sky. An idea, do you have the pounds, how much they weigh? A small cat or something like that?
So we took that in kilograms, of course. But I think it was somewhere around like 7 to 8 pounds, both of them. One mm-hmm. was a little larger.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, what specific data is of most interest to you? What questions do you want to answer by tracking these young eagles?
Sure. So our project is really trying to look at, as folks are aware, you know, eagle populations have increased dramatically as of late, and increasingly eagles are moving away from large riparian corridors, the Mississippi River and other big rivers, to interior portions of Iowa and Illinois. And when they're moving to the interior portions of the state and why they're moving there, and what sort of human structures they're interacting with is largely unknown. So we want to better understand where these eagles are going, so you know we can perhaps limit their mortality when they're in those portions of the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and intelligently site development of not just wind facilities, but communication towers, transmission lines, just development in general.
Mm-hmm. How hazardous are wind turbines to eagles? Do we know how many they kill each year, for instance?
So we know, so it's not certainly not one of their top mortality sources, wind turbines in general. To put it in context, you know, less than 10 eagles in the state of Iowa have been documented having collided with a wind turbine. I think the message is more that, you know, eagles and wind turbines are going to increasingly interact because there's going to be more eagles in that neck of the woods, and clearly wind development continues to increase. And so I don't know that the number is that important, but for a guy like me, you know, maybe one eagle is too much, right? So if there's
exactly.
a way we can keep both, you know, the bird and the wind farm operating in a good way,
yeah,
you know, we should do that. And I think through a project like this where we can identify places of high eagle use and when that's happening, it could really help us in the future.
For decades, of course, power lines have been a big hazard for eagles, injuring and killing many of them on a regular basis. With the wind turbines, they're so much larger. I guess I'm asking you to kind of get in the head of the eagle. Eagles are incredibly agile animals. Why can't they avoid these props? They deal with other fast-moving things in their natural environment.
Yeah, well, so not an eagle, but I'll try to answer like I am one. So much like, you know, you mentioned, you know, utility lines, and that's much the same thing. That's a static object, right? But you know, in Iowa, we have more issues with eagles colliding with lines than we do being electrocuted on lines. And one would think that an eagle could avoid, you know, a static object in the air. And you're right, wind farms are large. I think what most biologists think is occurring, so most of our mortality happens in the winter. You know, rivers are frozen. Eagles are searching for carrion, roadkill deer, or perhaps livestock that's, you know, died on the landscape, and that's what they're looking for. And so, you know, if you can imagine, you're an eagle flying around pretty high in the sky, and you're got your head pointed down looking for food, not necessarily looking straight ahead for that obstacle, whether it be a wind farm or a communication tower or a transmit, whatever it is, you know, if eagles are not designed to be looking for obstacles a mile in the sky, because historically they didn't exist.
Drew, as we try to protect the eagle population, it was way down a few decades ago, and this is really a success story, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, I think eagles are looked at as a real conservation victory for, you know, not just my agency, but, you know, the community, the conservation community in general. And, you know, I think the important message is, you know, oftentimes, you know, the recovery was credited with, you know, environmental legislation like the Endangered Species Act, the removal of DDT and that kind of thing, and certainly all that helped. But I think the message that I'd like to get out is that, you know, 40 years ago, we thought that it would be nearly impossible to recover the eagle population to where it is today. And the way we were able to recover it was not one agency or one act that Congress was able to get through. It was the conservation community as a whole coming together for a common cause and really tackling a problem. And we had the support of the public. And look where we are today. You know, I don't think anyone would fathom we'd have eagles in every county in Iowa. And so when we look at these other complex issues like white nose syndrome in bats, like invasive species, water quality in general, you know, I think all these problems, you know, today look like they're nearly impossible to solve. But eagles provide us a really good example that when we get together as a conservation community and the public as a whole, we can achieve some amazing results. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that those other problems that I mentioned, you know, we're going to be able to solve.
Okay, Drew Becker, thank you for filling us in about Star and Sky. The two baby eagles have now been tagged. They'll be tracked so that we can hopefully better protect the eagle population here in Iowa from the hazards of man-made objects. Drew Becker, fish and wildlife biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, talking to us from the Quad Cities. Drew, you mentioned the eagle camera. Can you tell us quickly how our listeners can look at these eagles?
Sure, you can go to just alcoa.com and you'll find the eagle camera. Just search Alcoa Eagle Cam, and it'll pop right up on any kind of search page.
Okay, Drew Becker, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Do have a look at that eagle cam. I have been looking at it, and some really improvements in eagle cams. High-definition eagles in their nest. They were having a bite to eat just a little while ago. Maybe you want to check out that. Drew said, you can just Google Alcoa Eagle Cam, and that one is in Riverdale. Well, as long as we're talking about eating, from pizzas and soups to deli meats, dips, and hamburgers, many of our diets are packed with salt. This we know. On Wednesday of this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration moved to cut average salt consumption by a third, this in an effort to reduce heart attacks and strokes. The agency issued draft guidelines for major food manufacturers and big chain restaurants designed to reduce salt in hundreds of products. Joining us now to explain what these guidelines may mean, Ruth Litchfield joins us again, State Nutrition Extension Specialist and Associate Chair of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University. Ruth, welcome back to our program.
Well, it's good to be here, Ben.
Tell us a little bit more about these new guidelines, proposed guidelines, and what's behind them.
Okay. Well, and I think one of the things that we want to make sure is, first of all, these are draft. They are open for public comment at this point in time. So it's not anything written in stone at this point, but it's a recommendation from the Food and Drug Administration to take some steps towards lowering the sodium content in our diets. And, you know, food manufacturers have a major role in that, since the majority of our sodium currently comes from the food supply in the form of processed foods. So this is a draft guidance. And also, the other thing to keep in mind is this is a voluntary program they're recommending. They have a 2- and 10-year target for this project, but it's a voluntary process. However, I think you're going to see a lot of the food industry come on board. This is something they have been working on because it has been an issue for a period of time. But this might spur it along a little bit more. And finally, the other thing that I'd like to kind of clarify right off the top is, you know, the interchangeable of using the terms salt and sodium. And I think many people understand that salt is composed of both sodium and chloride. So 40% of that salt is actually sodium. And so we're not just talking salt. We're also talking sodium that's used for a lot of different purposes. It's primarily used as a preservative. So it's not just talking about, you know, using the salt shaker. We're talking about the sodium that occurs in our food supply because it's being used as a preservative. It's being used for texture, mm-hmm. being used for flavor, fermenting, those types of things. So it's much broader than just what you're seeing in your shaker at the table.
Okay, so what is the difference there in terms of health implications of those two elements?
Well, keep in mind, sodium is our primary concern. You know, it's been linked to higher sodium intakes are linked to higher levels of high blood pressure, which we know are primary risk factors for both heart disease and stroke, which are leading causes of death. You know, when you look back at the dietary guidelines, the Institute of Medicine, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they have gone over numerous studies and have established that they are recommending 2,300 milligrams of sodium a day.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, our American population is consuming about 3,500 milligrams a day. So we're about 50% over that recommended range.
Mm-hmm.
So this program that's being proposed to have the food industry start moving some targets to lower the sodium in their products, their estimates would be that in 2 years we could have the average consumption of sodium in this country down to 3,000, and at 10 years we would meet that target of 2,300.
We would assume with a significant impact on people's health overall.
Oh, absolutely. When you look at decreasing rates of hypertension, which lead to the heart disease, the stroke, you're looking at decreasing mortality. You're also looking at millions, if not billions, in healthcare savings that they're projecting with this change.
Mm-hmm. Let me bounce off a quote from Leo Bruner off you. He's chief science officer at the Grocery Manufacturers Association. This is the industry's biggest lobbying organization. In reading about this latest FDA move, he said, like others inside and outside of government, we believe additional work is needed to determine the acceptable range of sodium intake for optimal health. He would lead us to believe that the science is unclear here, is it?
There is still some controversy. Yes, actually, just 2 weeks ago, another study came out in Lancet. This was a study that was involving 49 countries and 130,000 people, and they looked at the relationship between sodium intake and death. And some of their results suggest that the 2,300 actually would be too low for some of the population, so that to say this is a recommendation for the general population, they're suggesting it's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, they actually suggested that a low sodium intake was linked with higher mortality, but it's unclear. I haven't had a chance to actually look at the study design. You know, did they exclude people who, let's say, had cancer, and so from treatment of the cancer led to you know, decreased intakes, and it wasn't the low sodium that was the cause of death, but actually the cancer, you know. So I haven't had the opportunity to see some of the study design to really see if they've really accounted for all of the other factors that may have led to death beyond just the sodium. But yes, it's definitely still, there's controversy out there. But, you know, in looking at the majority of the studies, the Institute of Medicine and the Dietary Guidelines Committee has really feels that this recommendation was still appropriate because here in the United States, we do tend to have higher sodium intake. It's a worldwide thing, but in the United States, even more prevalent. We also have higher rates of stroke and cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm.
So for this country, at this point in time, it appears to be appropriate. But again, the science is evolving, and I'm not going to say there isn't controversy. Yes, there is, but we have to look at the evidence as a whole, not just individual studies.
Okay, thank you very much, Ruth Litchfield of Iowa State University, where she is State Nutrition Extension Specialist and Associate Chair of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Always good to talk with you, Ruth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Springfield is, perhaps you know this fictional town in which the American animated sitcom The Simpsons is set, but Springfield is also the name of a virtual city. in Iowa City at the University of Iowa's National Advanced Driving Simulator. It's used to study human response to new driving technologies. It's the largest in the world of its kind. John Gasper is with us, assistant research scientist at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. Hi, John.
Hi, Ben.
Wanted to quickly have you update us on a few things here. Tell us first about driving around in Springfield, because this is a stationary car you get into.
So it's actually inside our really high-fidelity simulator. So there's actually some motion. It moves around inside an area that's the size of about a basketball gymnasium. But it's inside a simulator. You're sitting inside a real car and moving around a bay.
And you look out the windows, you look at the controls. It feels like you're driving.
Yep, we have a full 360-degree view. The idea is to make it feel as much like driving as possible.
Okay, so what types of things does this allow you to study?
Really allows us to test a bunch of different questions. Most recently, we're looking at the interaction between humans and automation as people are kind of transferring control to and from cars that can drive themselves in some sense. And we can really put people in dangerous situations that we couldn't put people in the real world, mm-hmm. times when the automation might fail or they might have to respond very quickly.
You can have a car crash. You can actually hit people.
Exactly.
And they're just virtual, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's talk about the move towards driverless cars. We have semi-automated cars at your simulator. I've been out with Dan McGehee and
sure.
going in some of these test drives with these new cars that are doing more and more for us. So talk about adaptive cruise control. This is an optional cruise control system. Some cars have it now that keeps you a safe distance from cars in front of you and behind you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It kind of locks on to the traffic, the car in front of you, and it can kind of keep a safe gap between you and that car that you're following.
Mm-hmm. So with the simulator, what in particular are you looking at when it comes to adaptive cruise control?
So our recent work, we just published a report last week, I think, of some work we'd done a few years ago that looked at kind of early adopters of that technology, people who had that in their cars in the last few years and had some experience. And we wanted to see how people who had experience with that technology, how that influenced their behavior in situations where that automation might fail, when the cruise control might fail.
Mm. What did you find?
We actually found that they were pretty good in terms of realizing when they needed to take control from that system, better than people who had less experience with that, with the automated cruise control. Interestingly, we did find that there were still some misunderstandings. People didn't necessarily understand exactly how the automated cruise control worked in specific situations, even when they had a lot of experience. So we mm-hmm. found that kind of education was still probably really important.
Shouldn't technology, you want technology to be intuitive, that you don't need to get out the manual to understand it, right? So is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, and it is in some sense, but there's some, particularly in situations that are very challenging or very rare where crashes might occur, people tend to kind of have some, I guess, preconceptions of what should be happening in those situations. And because they don't experience them very, very often, they don't necessarily know how their car is going to respond or what they might need to do.
Mm-hmm. Adaptive cruise control, will we all have it within 5-10 years?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about the distressing figure that we saw, especially last month, but Iowa's roads are as dangerous as ever. 144 people have died on our state's roads so far this year, according to the Iowa DOT. I just checked a few minutes ago. That's a four-year mm-hmm. high, nearly 40 of those deaths in last month, in the month of May alone. Any ideas?
Sure.
Do you concern yourself with sort of upticks like this in the statistics, horrible statistics?
We do. It's something that we track for sure. I think we want to kind of understand what's driving that increase in crashes. From our perception, we don't know for sure, but it seems to be, or we would guess, I think, probably a number of issues at play, things like intoxication, distraction, kind of all of the typical culprits.
Right. The governor wants to find more effective ways of keeping drunk drivers off the roads.
Sure.
But also, when I drive around, what I see are people really distracted by their electronic devices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking out the window. I'm saying, come on, put it down. Pay attention. That has to be something that's feeding into the distraction and into the increase in crashes. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, we think so. Particularly tasks that take your eyes off the road for any prolonged period of time, things like texting, are particularly dangerous. And it remains an issue, and it remains kind of a question of what we should be doing about it. whether we ban those devices or kind of create cars that can detect when you're distracted and give you some sort of warning to get your eyes back on the road.
Mm-hmm. Some states have more restrictive laws than we do here in Iowa, mm-hmm. don't they?
Yeah, some states will ban any kind of cell phone interactions, even handheld cell phone conversations. Here in Iowa, I believe it's just texting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much. The summer months, of course, people driving to get to vacation spots and so forth. But I want to thank you very much, John Gasper, for keeping us up to date on research at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa, their virtual city, Springfield. It's based on Iowa City. So it seems like you're driving around Iowa City, huh?
Yep. And we actually have a virtual Iowa City that you can drive around. It looks just like the downtown capital area.
John Gasper, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon with help from Lauren Knutson. Monday on the program, we begin our series of conversations with members of Iowa's congressional delegation. I'll welcome Democratic Representative Dave Loebsack. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.